I don't know if you know this, but during this trial in my neighborhood, there's nothing much that goes on in my neighborhood. It's a little town, East County, and some teenage boys had some exchanges, and somebody said they had a gun. Well, pretty soon the Oakley police was in town around my neighborhood, and they're never there, never. And the whole year I've been there, I've never seen them. So I went out front to see what the commotion was about. They had everybody that had taken their nightly stroll in handcuffs in the back seats of their cars. They had about six cars. Mm-hmm. And one lady, this is why I was upset, she had just lost her son 2 weeks prior to sickle cell. And so she's still in mourning, and she's got these two little toddlers, well, not toddlers, they're 8 and 9, and they're riding their bikes, and she always gathers them up at dusk, because safe neighborhood, we all, you know, it's, you don't worry so much about kid snatching, although who knows where, but I'm just saying. And she's out there trying to round up her babies. She's in the back seat of police car handcuffs. But that's not the biggest aspect of it all. The boy who lives directly across from me comes home all weekend from college. He came out after lifting weights and stands out on his stoop, and the cops draw guns and say, "Get on the ground." And he says, "I just got stepped out of my house. Get on the ground." They grab him and throw him headfirst into the gutter, scraping up his head, and throw him in the backseat of the car handcuffed. His father's livid. He says, "I want your badge number," because not a single cop had a badge on with a name. And
no way.
I swear to you. And he was so upset in wanting this from this officer. An officer says, continue our investigation. Don't interrupt us. And I said, I'll get the badge number. Don't worry. Just calm down. So I went up to him. I said, "Sir, could I have your badge number, please?" He says, "If one more of you say one more thing, you're all going to jail." And so I just walked away very slowly. And I said, "Boy, the Oakley Police Department really needs to be investigated." And then the older cop with the gray hair just snarled at me. But, you know, this is the kind of thing I see all the time. But it goes on all the time. I mean, they're just overzealous. They're quick to act. Mm-hmm. The guns are out. They could go off anything. God forbid if I would have been walking my Rottweiler that night. He'd probably be dead.
Were these white people or black people?
The boy that came out on the curb, the one that was handled very aggressively, he was black.
He was black.
Of course.
And the woman who was handcuffed?
Of course.
And the woman who was handcuffed in the back of
black.
The car?
Black.
Right, of course. Okay.
Black. A Christian, devout Christian, mind you.
No. But,
I mean, I'm just saying, it didn't fit. The most sweetest, loving woman in the world. She's right. Married to a man from Panama. I mean, they're a beautiful, gorgeous family.
We probably have about 20 minutes left right. for this interview.
Oh, sorry.
Okay.
Yeah,
no, that's good. No, that was a great story, though.
This is great.
But that was wonderful. And
I mean, it's tragic.
You tuned to Women on Wednesday, and we're interviewing Mary Nunn, and we're talking about the Judy Barry, Daryl Cherney versus the FBI Oakland Police case. And Maria B. was the Afro-American attorney for the Oakland Police.
Yeah.
And what did the jury think of her argument that the use
of
the name Mississippi Summer and the Redwoods or in any way drawing parallels with the nation's most well-known civil rights struggle was the demeaning to black people.
To me, she was a joke. I'm sorry. To me, she was a joke. I grew up in an all-black neighborhood. I know a lot of professional black women, many so. One being my mother-in-law, whom was a president of an electronics firm in Foster City, bought and sold 5 homes mm-hmm. all by herself, coming to town 50-some years ago with $5 in her pocket and 4 boys in tow, and she levitated to this level. Mm-hmm. No one can fill her shoes. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, she'd come up this fake smile, mm-hmm. and her whole purpose was, it wasn't the Oakland PD, now was it? It was the FBI agent that was there, now wasn't it? My people didn't have anything to do with that. Isn't that correct? And once they would say, maybe. Okay, thank you. And she'd sit down. And that was it. Her only thing was to exonerate the Oakland PD. Never giving rhyme or reason for anything, just making sure they weren't put in the pot. And that didn't excuse them from the plot, because she got one of her people to say that they weren't. It didn't mean anything to me. All those people were paid. The doctor, they had this doctor there that was making $500 an hour to testify. I mean, come on. I would have got up there and said whatever they wanted for $500.
$5,000, right?
Oh, I think we got 5,000. I'm sorry. More than I can conceive
right.
of. But it was 500 even. Is
yeah,
something.
Right.
I mean, but what a joke. I mean, come on. The guy was paid $5,000 an hour, and you're supposed to trust what he says? Come on.
$5,000? Well, maybe it was $500 an hour. Who knows?
I don't know. I mean, come on. Does that make you want to believe in this guy? And he was a real kind of you could just tell a real, I don't know, just
right.
make your skin crawl kind of guy. That
right.
His only motivator in life is money.
So yeah. What does that say about his character?
Right, and Judy's doctor came and testified for nothing because he took care of her and he...
Oh, yeah. I mean, the only person I did trust was her doctor because he was firsthand and he was ethical and he seemed like his only intention was to tell the truth. And most doctors are that way. That doctor, I would never want to have anything to do with him. Any doctor that would... Doesn't he make enough money over there on the South Bay where he has to come over and do such tactics? I mean, they already rob you over there anyway because it's too pricey to live. So I can't understand it. But no, I only went by what her doctor said and what her injuries projected. And her injuries said it all as to where the bomb was.
Yeah.
For me. I mean, that was it. Once I heard what happened to her... Nobody's going to set themselves up like that to harm themselves in that way. They were both educated people. They weren't dummies. She's not going to do something like that. It was ridiculous. It was a ridiculous concept. And where they ever thought anyone was going to buy... See, they never thought they'd be in this setting. That's why they did this this chaos. They never thought it would ever get to this place in time. If they had, they probably would never have done the things they did. Because if they had ever known it would be presented in front of a jury... especially in 2002.
Mm-hmm.
We're just too far ahead of that. We're not buying that. We've seen too much corruption on the TV. Too many beatings, too much misconduct, too much corporate scoundrels running blatant. Our president has a crook watching the crooks, the guy from Providian. I mean, what kind of joke is that? I mean, they're just running rampant in the world. We just tolerated them. We had to sit there and go through the process. It was all very insultive and all very obnoxious, but you had to sit there and be polite and tolerate them. You had to go through the process. It was difficult, but we did it.
Now some of the jury, in fact, probably the majority of the jury, never would have imagined that law enforcement would behave in this way. Is that right?
They didn't think they would risk their jobs.
Risk their jobs.
But the thing is, their jobs are never in jeopardy. They can act this way and do whatever they want under the sun with God watching, and they're never held in account. The only time they're ever held in account on rare occasions is someone has a video camera in hand. That's the only time. Mm-hmm. But do you know how many times there's no video camera around? Those are rare occasions. So it happens every day.
Right.
Every
day. You watched it happen in your neighborhood.
That's not the only place I've seen it happen.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just the most recent place I've seen
right.
it happen.
Right. So I'm having calls come in on the phone. Can I, like, run them by and you can choose?
Run by questions that
they're asking? A couple of questions.
You choose the questions. You think there's some good questions out there?
Yeah.
Throw them one out.
Someone wanted to know why Chennault was treated differently than the other defendants.
In what facet?
The caller seemed to think that Chennault was more protected than the rest, and I don't really have a frame of reference for that. So,
I don't believe so. I think Chennault was held accountable for the things in which he did, such as the search warrant. He got fined profusely. As far as the search itself, because he was on the FBI helicopter, he was found guilty. I think he got handled appropriately.
He wasn't a supervisor. That might be
right.
Part of it.
Yeah, that's why. I think for
uh-huh.
what his... You yeah. see, what you understand is he was new on the force. He was trying to win brownie points. He was trying to fit in with the white boys. And this is how he went about doing it. And it's sad, but that's what he did. I mean, people do things to earn brownie points and to fit in. He was new in homicide. He was with the drug force for a while. Uh-huh. And I could imagine the stuff he left behind there. I could imagine... You know, I don't want to even fathom the thought, but the guy was, as much as we could do with the conservative jury that we had, mm-hmm. we got what we could on him as much as possible. We worked with what we had. We did not protect him
okay.
by any means. By any means. He thinks that he does. He thinks he's not defined by how we ruled. He says, all my years of service is not defined by this act. Well, in actuality, it is, because it shows America that you lie on search warrants and you find that's quite commonplace and there's nothing mm-hmm. wrong with it. And why should it be questioned? So, yeah, it does show that something's wrong with your character, very much so.
Okay, and one that was of particular concern to our listeners was the Spike a Tree for Jesus song. How did that affect the jury?
First of all, I don't think that anyone in my jury was really religiously moved one way or another. If they did, they didn't attest to it. I didn't see anything like that. Nobody really said too much about it.
It wasn't discussed during deliberations.
No, it wasn't even brought. It wasn't even part of anything. we didn't format anything behind that song. It wasn't even brought up, not once. If you want to know how I funneled it, I thought it was just... what it did is it characterized the crucifixion of character that they did on those two. If the only relation I made with the song, as far as crucifying Jesus, I mean, they crucified these two people's whole character. They smeared them. So that's the only crucification I could tie in with the song. I'm probably the most religious one on the jury, meaning that I have a very intimate relationship with my Father in heaven. I love him profusely. There's not anything I don't do that I don't interact with him, first and foremost, be it big or small. I don't have anyone else. I'm an orphan, per se. I really am. So when I have problems in life, I go to him. I mean, and then I hope he's listening, you know, and I hope he directs me. But the thing is, I know who killed Jesus. You know, the Romans killed Jesus. I mean, it's like ridiculous. I mean, we're going to all be misled? I mean, come on. We're grown-up people. We know our history. So it's the song's
so
not
people
gonna...
got that it was a satire.
Of course. Of course.
Okay. So do you think the jury was afraid to find the FBI and Oakland Police liable? Was
I think so. Yeah. I think they thought there would be some repercussion. That's why they all diverted. That's why they all hid. That's why they won't speak out. They're scared. I'm not a scary type. Maybe that's going to be my downfall, but I'm not a scary type. And it doesn't mean that I haven't had things happen within my life that would make you scared. I've been in many, many trying situations, but it made me stronger. I get stronger from events. I don't weaken. So the more I'm subjected to, the more stronger I get. So it's more... once you get something, go through something and overcome it, you become stronger. You don't become weaker. So, but for them, they diverted. They were reclusive. They wanted to do that. They were discussing they would do that anyway, way before. But they also said they wanted whatever they did on that verdict form was going to be something that would make their kids proud and that they could sleep at night and that they could sit with. So, even though I'm very boisterous. There's no way I ruled for everyone in that room. I mean, everyone did it of their own mind. I'm just the only one that's willing to speak out because, well, you know, if something happens to me, then you all know who did it, because I don't have any enemies, I'll tell you right now. I have none. None that I know of. So if something happens to me, they're directly responsible. I tell you that 100%. So
right on. So 80, speaking of speaking out, 80% of the total damage award was for First Amendment violations. How did the defendants violate the First Amendment rights? And, you know, and during the trial, what aspects of that moved you the most?
Okay, well, I guess the aspect of they put them under arrest, the TV smears.
Listen, describe that for listeners who, okay. A lot of listeners here just have radio.
Okay, first of all, our orders from Claudia Wilkins was not to watch any TV, not to read any books, not any news articles. She said we could watch news and read the current affairs, but if you saw something that addressed the trial, turn the page or turn the channel. And we all followed suit. So we didn't go out of our way to research anything. We all stayed stringent on that ruling. We didn't... I think we wanted this case so much, and we wanted to do some good in this case so much. We didn't want to do anything to put us in the subjection of losing it. Mm-hmm. So we followed all the rules. And as we were following the rules of the case...
So there was a TV... The TV smear happened right after the bombing.
Right,
You didn't see any of that.
No, so see, I'm learning... Right. As I'm going along, because I don't remember this case.
Did they introduce that video footage as evidence?
Yes, they did.
Okay.
And that video footage was the first I ever saw of any newscast. I was wanting something. I was wanting to see some old newspapers of back then, but I had no access to anything. I'm not online. I don't have any access. And I have a computer, but I'm not online. And it's unfortunate, but I'm not. And... So I mean, I wouldn't have dared anyway, looked up during it, but I'm just saying, even after the fact, I had no access. So it's, I totally went in there, you know, not knowing anything. And when they started rolling it, you know, the footage, and also they presented the case and they attested the fact what had happened to these people through their smearing and through Sims' nightly addresses on the TV screen, talking about these are the only subjects. These are the only ones we're focusing on. There are no others, but we're open. But these are the guys, and these are the bombers. These are who we have. We're open to more information, but we're focused. You know, we're going to cue in on these two. And they smeared them, and the news went cross-country, and people no longer wanted to be associated with these folks. I mean, maybe some. Maybe they're stringent friends, but some were like, do we really want this? This looks bad. You know, we've got this prop out. They lost the proposition.
Right, top 130.
Yeah, I mean, not by much, but they did lose it. They probably would have gained more had this not happened. People were scared to attach themselves to them. When they went out and when they finally settled back into their homes, their kids were taunted. They were taunted. They walked in fear. They were limited. I mean, somebody said their voice was stronger. Like, heck, it was stronger. How could it be stronger once you know someone blew up half of your body? What's left to say they won't do it again? They weren't caught. Gives them more incentive to do it again. Normally, you keep on going till you're caught. That's how most thieves and crimes persist. They keep doing it till they're caught. And so I think they were in danger from that point on, and they were very leery, very leery. So, yeah, they stifled them. Yeah, they quieted their voice. So, absolutely, they were in violation of First Amendment. They lived in fear from that time on, and probably till this day. I'm in fear a bit. Honestly, I'm in fear a bit. But, you know, I can't let it stagnate me. I can't let it stagnate me. Yeah.
It's a terrible thing that when the government and the forces that are supposed to support us, when we're afraid of them and we're righteously afraid of them, that just seems to me to be... It seems to me that there's so many people all over the country, and if you ask them, they'll tell you they're afraid. They're afraid of their own government. They're afraid of their police. They're afraid of, you know.
Look what they did to Ernest Hemingway.
Right.
I mean, come on. I mean, throughout history, they have the power to harm people. Big people. They brought down big people, let alone little people. Even my husband said, why don't you watch it, honey, before you end up in the bay? You said enough. You've done your part. You did your gig. Please stop. And I didn't, you know, I didn't tell him about my visit here today because I don't want to worry him. You know, I don't want to worry my husband unnecessarily because he's got enough to contend with, bills and kids and everything else, and I want him to focus on that. This is something for me. This is between me and my heart. That's why I do it. It's not about my husband. My husband wasn't in the room. He can't relate to what I feel or what moves me, but I feel a need to talk about this because mm-hmm. it was such a dishonorment to these folks, and they do these things. And America needs to wake up and be aware.
Well, they're asking for money right now to do more of it.
Yeah, of course they are. And, you know, that's kind of a joke, you know, because of the setting I work in, you know.
Where do you work?
I work for American Airlines.
Ooh.
And I work in a passenger service. I'm a ticket agent, and we're dealing with the baggage and the x-rays and the targeting and what have you. And it's really funny, well, just to give you a little insight how cutting edge our FBI are, this is just how intelligent they so very are. Our security process is designated to the T of what those guys did that day. If you buy, well, I can't even say. I'm not going to say what it is because would be...
Right, we can guess.
Don't tell us.
But it's to the T. Nothing less, nothing more, but exactly to the T. They don't even have a few steps ahead. So they're not cutting edge. They're not street savvy. The thing that happened at LL Airlines should tell you that. That should have never happened.
Uh-huh.
See, if they were really protecting us, that ticket agent wouldn't be shot. You understand me?
Yes.
So that, see, because the security point should start out there on that roadway as you proceed to the airport, not when you're at the security point yards away from the plane. If there's seven guys with machine guns and there's one cop, they're already gotcha. You understand me?
Yes.
So that one cop's not going to do anything but get shot. And feel his family's going to mourn. They're not prepared. We got one cop protecting Oakland Airport. That's it. And he's sitting. Oh, three, excuse me. Three. For how many people? How many thousands and thousands of people? How many airplanes? We've got three cops, and they're sitting down, and they're in conversation. Go ahead, check them out. Observe them. They're not on guard. The National Guard's gone, and they didn't have any rounds in their guns anyway. I know, because some of our guys are military, and they told me as such. And all the pilots say, thank God they left the axe in the cockpit, because that's your last line of defense. It's not the cops. And it's not the FBI. They're not protecting us. You better know how to drop and roll. That's the only protection you have. Honestly.
Yeah.
They're only into their income and retiring. That's it. They're big, savvy incomes and retiring. And getting into as least harm as possible so that they can retire. We all want to retire. That's our heyday, right? We do what we have to do now so we can do what we want to do then. So this is what they do. This is what they do best. So, do you see them finding any of the missing babies? Even one?
Heck no.
Mm-hmm. Not one. Do they take out the FBI helicopter to find the missing baby, which is so pertinent within the first hour? Do they do that? Hell no, they don't do it. But they go and they smear two innocent hippies up north. I mean, what's that about? Because you know why? Because it's harmless. They won't get hurt.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Well, that's the story. Why do they bust marijuana instead of speed? Because they won't get hurt.
Well, honestly, that's... I don't know if you guys watched 2020 last night. That's out of control anyway. You know what I mean? That's out of control.
What was on 2020 last night?
Drugs in America as opposed to Holland and how they should legalize it and control it because it's out of control. Mm-hmm. You're not... Once you kill one drug lord, there's another one to step up. And
uh-huh. Well, it's the same thing. It's about making money and being safe. It's not about being, shall we say, a real person relating to real people in the real world. You're right. They're so out of touch.
Yeah, they're not. A lot of these guys, they come from really conservative backgrounds, and then they go to school and they get educated. But these guys aren't from the streets.
Hey, I got a good question over the phone.
Yeah.
Caller wants to know, how did you mask your wonderfulness to get chosen for the jury?
tips
for getting chosen.
I don't know that I did. What I did do is they asked me, "Will you, by Almighty God, be fair?" And I said, "By my Almighty God, I will." And I meant that. And when I left that courtroom, what did I do? I got into prayer in the car on the way home. I got into prayer and I said, "Dear Lord Father, open my mind to see the truth in this. If I don't understand something, give me the insight to see it. Let me see the truth in this, please." Even when I would deliberate and I didn't know what to say, I would ask God, give me the insight to make sense to my fellow jurors, to talk so that I'm clear, so that you can understand me. And I consorted with him in all of it because I'm new at this. I was lost. I didn't know what I was about to embark upon. And I needed his guidance and I needed his insight. Who better to consult than he, huh? And so what happened is a direct result of what he wanted to happen. Believe you me, God don't get behind bad. Okay, and what
that's right. God only get behind good.
That's right. Yeah. But that's what prevailed. And we took our time. You're talking 2 months of trial and another 3 weeks of deliberation. We took our time. And we had flyers all over the room. We had columns. We'd have Chenault's name. We'd have Doyle's name. We'd have Senna's name. We'd have all the key players, Reich's, all of them. And we went down a list of how they contributed to the dysfunction of that day, and we went through it all. We didn't talk money till the very last week. Does that sound like someone who rushed or tried to burn these guys at the stake?
Right.
The last week. Because it was more important to find out what they did and how much they did than burn them at the stake. We wanted to be sure. You know what I mean? We didn't want to rush. We wanted to be sure, and that's exactly what we did. We took our time. It was painful at times because we were all convinced they were guilty. So let's start talking the money. This is what this is about. And it was hard to get those wheels rolling, but eventually they did. Mm-hmm. And when that's why I guess once the money came out on the board and it was settled, I was so exhausted because it was such a fight to get it out on the board that I didn't get involved with where it went. I had a pacifier in my mouth once the money was out, and I knew it wasn't going to lower. And I knew it was going to stay right there. I had a pacifier, and I literally shut down because I had put too much in it emotionally. So I shut down. It's like I was just happy.
Hey, Mary.
Yeah.
Let's end this interview with talking a little bit about Judy Barry and what your impressions of her was. And she really was the force and the spirit that took this case where it did go.
Well, what I thought of her was, me not knowing a lot about what she was involved in initially, but coming to know it. And, I think we all appreciate this beauty that I'm surrounded by here today. We all want it, but we're not going to take time out of our day or incomes to make it happen. Very few are. Everybody's chasing that almighty dollar. We're all motivated by money. Not all of us. Remote few aren't. Unique individuals aren't. Someone that's that driven and that dedicated to do what she did for that length of time, it really says something about someone. And she was very eloquent. I had the privilege of someone mailing me some tapes. One of the editors of a newspaper, he said to give me an interview, and I said, I'd really like to see some tapes on
on Judy, and if you have anything, because, you know, I want to get acquainted with her. The judge says we can go online and we can research and we do all these things. We can talk to media. So, hey, if you got something, I really would appreciate it. So Nicholas sent me something, and I've been watching it quite a bit. I rewind it, I watch it, and I've got acquainted with her through those videos to some respect. I couldn't absolutely know her in total, but it gave me some insight as to who she was. And not only that, even in court, her deposition was very moving. I didn't know, though, it didn't come out till after court. Did they hush him on that as well, that she was that close to death? They didn't let on, I don't believe. But it wasn't prominent in my mind that she was a month to her death. To me, I'd be too depressed to want to talk about it. But she was even moved then. She didn't let her impeding death get in the way of her giving her address. She still wanted justice to prevail, even if she wasn't here. So that in itself was gorgeous. I mean, come on. I mean, I would be depressed. I'd be in a shell. I wouldn't want to talk to anyone because I'm going to die soon, you see? And that's something I wouldn't want to do, probably, huh? And I mean, I love life as it is. So for her to be able to do that. Another thing I didn't know is, I read later that her ashes were there in a burlap sack with beautiful roses, or flowers, rather. And I saw the box, and I thought it was pretty. I didn't. They always had something on the table, like flowers, or something that was, you know, fruitful. And so I didn't think there was ashes, and I read later, and that was very nice as well, that they brought her for the day of the verdict. And then it was a pleasant verdict to her ears.
Right on.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it was good. It was really
absolutely
good. And I don't know if you know this, when we were deliberating, we would tape things to the wall, and then we'd be quiet. And you know, something would fly off the wall, and nobody even moved. And we used to think spirits were in the room, in the courthouse. Because stuff would fly off the wall.
Judy Barry's spirit was definitely
there. And it
there.
Probably wasn't. You know whose paper it was? It was Doyle's.
Whoa.
Yeah. I mean, boy, I mean, it just, and we would say, whoa, the spirits are moving. And so it was, but it was, you know what's funny was Jerry, the judge, I'd always say, Jerry, do Claudia. And he would do like this. Well,
this is in the deliberation room.
Well, this is after we gave our verdict.
Right.
Okay. But I mean, we're waiting to hear her call us back in.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And he would just say, well. Okay.
Well, we've been speaking with Mary Nunn and a juror from the Judy Barry, Daryl Cherney versus the FBI trial. We're going to be wrapping it up here on Women on Wednesday.
Thank you, Bear. Thank you, Mary Nunn.
Thank you very, very much, Mary, for coming up here. And I'd also like to say thanks to Alex for riding up with her and keeping her company.
Right.
And I'd also like to say thanks to Bernadine Cunningham for coming in, and listeners don't know, but we've been having a multimedia experience here with video cameras going, and I feel like I'm on Democracy Now or something.
Yeah, you look like.
And I'd like to say one more thing. For more information, people with computers can go to www.judybarry.org. That's Judy with an I, Barry with an I, .org for much more information on the case.
Okay, this is Women on Wednesday. 2 hours can be so short. KMUD Garberville 91.1, KMUE Eureka Arcata 88.3 FM.